Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
So today's conversation, we're really going to talk about three areas, right? So the first one is really about what is growth and why does it matter, right? The second is really around going deep into key areas of growth. And lastly, we'll talk about what it takes to be a good product manager in growth. So let's start with growth. What is it? Why does it matter? It is a term that's been thrown around and been used significantly over the last few years in the industry. Let's unpeel it a little bit. So if you think about software product management and really think about consumer software product management even further, there's a really interesting quote that I like, which is around what metrics matter and what is really important in terms of growing a business or scaling a business. And ultimately, it really is about, are there enough users who use your product, and are they using it as frequently as you expect them to? So I'll come back to this over and over again because it sort of ties in everything. But really, when we think about growth, growth started as a term probably about 8 to 10 years ago. And it started as growth hacking. But people have shied away from the hacking part of it and now really starting to dig deeper into really what is growth. One way to explain this is, in a product company, in a sort of consumer-based, internet-based product company, you have product teams which used to focus on building core products, right? And then you have marketing teams who used to focus very specifically on just bringing in audiences, right? And think of these as your brand marketers, sometimes even as performance marketers, but just thinking about how do we get users to come visit your website or app, and that's it, right? Growth, in a lot of ways, is a marriage of these two. Right? So this is a function which really thinks about both product and marketing together, and in a lot of ways thinks about how do we get users to experience the core value of the product as often as possible. Right? And I'll flesh this out in a few things. Right? But let's talk about why this is important, right? And this goes back to some history in a lot of ways. About 15, 20 years ago, right, in the Valley or across the world, if you had great technology, that would be good, right? You had defensible ability to differentiate yourself, and you would be the IBM of the world, right? That started changing, and people started focusing on product a lot, right? And then the going in position was, if you have a great product, that's perfect, right? You're going to win, right? Great technology, great product, you're perfect. That's changed. Over the last 10, 12 years, that's changed. A lot of reasons for it, but really think about the number of companies that have exploded just because making great products and great technology has become so easy. Right? It's really easy to build an app nowadays. What's hard is distribution. Right? How do you make sure that you get the number of people to really adopt and understand your product and then scale the product? Right? So that's why now success is really about great technology, great product, and great distribution. Right? Here's another quote from Peter Thiel. If you guys know him, he's very famous, but really one of the co-founders of PayPal, wrote a good book called 0-1. And one of his quotes is pretty similar, right? It's poor distribution, not bad product, that leads to most failures. Right? So again, a good way of thinking about what we need or what we need to think through when we're starting to build products and when we're starting to build businesses. So let's talk about what exactly is growth. Another way of thinking about growth is it's really a multidisciplinary function with a data-driven, experiment-driven mindset applied to it to scale products. Right? That's the simplest way of thinking about it. The functions that are involved in this are all the way varied from design, marketing, to engineering, as well as data science. So let's talk a little bit about growth and a little bit about growth models. Right? So if you, again, go back to the quote, right? It's really about how do we get most people to be able to use your product? Right? So are enough people using your product and are they using it as frequently as you want them to? Right? So another way of thinking about that is from a simple mathematical equation, your total number of users are the new users that you acquire plus the users which you retain. Right? And that essentially makes up for your total sum of users. In a lot of ways, if you think about it from a function perspective, acquiring new users is a specific function. It's called acquisition. And there are lots of sort of ways to go through acquisition. We'll dig deep into that one. Retaining users, again, just because you acquire 1,000 users doesn't mean that they'll stay on and use your app or your product after 5 days, 10 days, a month, 2 months. Right? And that's critical, right? Because if you can't do that, you're going to have a leaky bucket, and then your acquisition doesn't matter. Right? It doesn't matter how much you spend or how many people you get if you can't keep them. Right? And a lot of that is around the science of retention and engagement. If you do both of those right, and you use data as a good foundation, then you have recipes for sustainable growth. This is another way of thinking about the growth model, fleshed out. We'll dig a lot more into each of the areas in growth model, and we'll dig into areas which are commonly used by a lot of industry experts, if it were. How do we use it? Right, so we talked about this equation, we talked about these areas, but how do we practically use it? Right? In companies that like Airbnb, Uber, Facebook, a growth model is really used for a variety of reasons, right? All the way starting from setting strategy, thinking about prioritization, predicting where your company is going, thinking about where to invest, right? And finally communicating, right? Again, all of these are really important things. And as product managers in the audience, we all think about this and we do this. This is a good way of systematically doing it and explaining it to everyone. Right? In a lot of ways, good growth teams and good growth models ultimately can form good operating systems using growth models. Right? And this becomes a great way of explaining to the rest of your company or to your team how your particular product is really going to grow. So hopefully all of you guys are with me. Now that we've established growth is important, and there are various ways in which we can think about growth, growth model is really important, let's dig a little deeper into growth models, right? And let's dig a little deeper into key areas and sort of talk about like what are some of the ways in which people think about this. So we'll start with acquisition. Right? This again, for reminder, this is about getting new users into your service, right? App, website, or product. Various ways sort of to do this, right? But there are large themes around or large areas by which software, again, internet-based companies are able to acquire users. Right? I'll go through four big categories. There are obviously many more. There are subcategories in all of these. And there are really companies and industries within each one of them. Right? So I'm not going to do justice by really explaining all of this, but I'll at least try to give you guys a little bit of an overview. Right? So search is something that most of us do. Right? Most of us have known this for a long time. Google's been around and has won this space for the longest time. Right? But it is one of the early ways in which growth really started, right? Because a lot of web 1.0 and sort of, you know, even 2.0 companies started leveraging Google search and Google ranking to try and get an advantage over their competitors, as well as try and get eyeballs from users who are searching for specific terms, right? And then, right, as people got deeper into this, there's a lot of science around this, right? All the way starting from how do we optimize for keywords, how do we optimize our own sort of site, how do we optimize for speed, the list goes on, right? But this is one of the critical ways in which people can actually get acquisition. But you need a certain company profile for this, right? You need to have some sort of content, some sort of reason for users to be trying to discover your product, right? So a simple example, and Airbnb does this a lot, is people traveling to for looking for hotels in Thailand, right? That's a simple keyword where it makes sense for companies in travel to try and make sure that they are coming up in the search terms. Let's talk a little bit about sort of a second or a different way of growing your company, right? And this is a term which is, you know, very well used. But the simplest way of thinking about virality is, does having one person, can they bring on more people into your product? That's the simplest way of thinking about virality. Is there a natural benefit to them? And is there a natural affinity for them to bring in more people? Right? This is a strategy used by various companies, right? All the way from Dropbox to, well, obviously Slack, Facebook, sorts, right? We use this as well. Right? As you can see on our website, there are various ways to think about virality. There are products which lend themselves really well to simple word of mouth or simple free virality, if it were, right? Products like Facebook or LinkedIn, they become better if you're inviting your friends or if you're inviting your coworkers, right? So there's a natural affinity for people to do that. There are products which use incentivized virality. Dropbox was one of the best examples of this again, where they really started this by saying, hey, let's give out certain space to users if they bring in a friend, right? And now you see this everywhere, right? You see this from food delivery services, Airbnb uses this as well. It's really around sort of a simple value exchange. Bring in a friend and you get certain percentage off your next trip or certain dollars and they'll get certain percentage off, right? It's a win-win. If you love the service, you're gonna do it, right? And this always has been one of the best ways to acquire customers. It's cheaper. You're always going to bring good, interested people in, at least most of the time. Right? So this is a second way in which the industry it focuses a lot on virality. The third is paid. Right? And paid has really come across in the last 5-7 years. Right? It's been around for some time, but companies are now increasingly using paid as a mechanism for acquisition. And really, again, paid is, think about Google, think about Facebook, and showing ads over there, right? You can do this if your service or if your product has some sort of revenue-generating potential, which is higher than how much you would pay on to show the ad. So the simple equation that is used in the industry is really around LTV greater than CAC. But what that means is the person you're acquiring, right? So say, for example, you pay $10 to show an ad and get someone to use your product or download your app. That person better spend $10 because I've already spent $10 showing an ad to that person. Right? So that's a simple way of thinking about paid advertising. This specific area has significantly grown as a lot of companies have specialized in this. This area has also gone into automation, right? Which is where a lot of engineering, a lot of data science, even design is sort of really putting a lot of thought around how do we do this in a way which is efficient and which scales. So that's the third one. And let's talk a little bit about the last one. This is affiliate marketing. Again, not a very new concept, but used very well by certain companies. One of the best examples of affiliate marketing is Amazon. And the simplest way of thinking about affiliate marketing is think about sort of influencer marketing, or think about a person or celebrity recommending a particular product. Right? You've all seen that in YouTube videos. You've seen that even in TV or movies. Right? This is a flavor of that, where you have websites or people writing blogs, people having well-informed opinions. And as those people have blogs in it, they can then recommend certain services. Right? That service provider, say for example, is say it's Dropbox, right? Say it's a blog on cloud computing and storage, and what are some of the best players in it? And Dropbox and Google Drive could participate as an affiliate marketer, show a small little ad over there, and if a user clicks on it and actually subscribes, the affiliate marketer pays to the website owner, right? So this is a good way to capture a lot of long tail, right? It's really hard to actually imagine how long the tail is, where content is being generated by a lot of thought leaders and a lot of influencers. And a lot of people do get influenced while making certain decisions, right? E-commerce, travel, B2B, these are all sort of industries where people research a lot before making a decision. And in those industries, affiliate marketing works really well. So those were sort of the four acquisition areas that I talked about. Again, various flavors within them. Right? The reason I picked these was to try and give you a spectrum of search and virality being much more on the free product side. So you have companies like Facebook and Slack or LinkedIn using those techniques because they can't afford to pay for paid marketing or affiliate. Right? Their business models are different. You have companies who can afford to pay for paid marketing or affiliate, Dollar Shave Clubs of the world, and those guys lean much more on the paid marketing and affiliates. A lot of companies do all. Right? That was the first section, which was acquisition. Let's talk a little bit about retention and engagement. So I think retention and engagement arguably is the most important part of growth. Right? And again, this was going back to my example of there's no use of acquiring millions and millions of users if you can't keep them. Right? There are so many examples in San Francisco and in the Valley where companies have not understood retention and engagement, not understood that their product is not ready yet, right? And have stepped on the gas too fast, right? As a result of that, try and acquired millions of users, lost all of them or nearly all of them in a few months, and you have nothing, right? You do not have a stable company, you do not have a stable product, right? So the way to think about retention and engagement, or at least one way of thinking about it, is to use a framework. Right? And the framework that I'm showing you guys is really around users. Think about users that come to your product and try to think about what sort of states they are in, right? Or they could be. Right? A simple breakdown of these states could be, let's take a product, right? For example, let's take Dollar Shave Club for whatever reason. You have visitors who are just about coming to their site and really, not even signing up, right? But visiting their site. They probably have millions and millions of visitors. Right? The next segment of users are people who actually sign up. Right? That's much lower. It's could be order of 10% of the visitors, could be order of 5%, maybe even lower. Right? And these are users who've still just signed up. Right? After a user signs up, a user can then actually pay for the service and be considered a real user, which is sort of the last bucket that I'm showing, right? And when you think about the last bucket, these are active users, right? So these users are now actually using the product on a monthly basis, right? You can categorize users in different segments over there, right? Some users might just buy one razor a month, right? Some users might buy three razors a month, right? And some users might actually buy the premium package, right? Whatever the premium package is, right? With special lather and special creams of sorts, right? Those are sort of different states of usage of an active user. Right? And of course, users could fall out, right? Users could be inactive the minute they sign up, like maybe they never even subscribe to it, or they could become inactive after they were an active user. So this is an interesting way of thinking about all of your users, all of your product users, and then dividing them up in different states. You can do the math on this. You can sort of think about how many users are there in each state and what's really happening with each user. Once you do that, then you think about sort of areas that you really want to improve when you think about retention and engagement. The starting point of how you want to improve retention and engagement is around activation. You want to get your users as quickly as possible to an aha moment. Right? What do I mean by aha moment? It's really the moment where the user understands the product and says, great, this value proposition makes a lot of sense for me. Right? There's a lot of science around how do you do that? Are there complex products where you need to handhold a person? Are these simple products where you want to try and land them to a certain place immediately? But you want to try and think through what's the right way of doing it. Right? One really good example that I've heard multiple times, is sort of both Facebook and Twitter. Right? So Facebook figured out that their aha moment was really around getting 10 friends. Right? So if a user signs up to Facebook, once they add 10 friends, is when they really started understanding what Facebook was, right? And this was years ago, right? But once the company understood that sort of insight, everything that they did for a new visitor and a new signup was around encouraging users to get those 10 users, right? And get those 10 friends, right? So this was an example. There are various other examples of what really is the moment where the user says, I totally understand this product, I get it, I see the value in it, and now I want to use it. And if you understand that about your product, then you want to try and design things to get the users there. The second area is really around engagement. Right? And this is for your active users. Right? So these are your users who are using it. But how do we get them to build a habit? Right? How do we get them to start thinking about using your product on a monthly basis or a weekly basis? Right? You want to think about what your natural frequency of usage is, right? Different products have very different frequencies, right? Something like Facebook is, you're probably going to do it like multiple times a day. Something completely different, like say a travel website, right? You're going to travel maybe 4 to 5 times a year, right? So there are different frequencies that naturally users gravitate towards. So you want to keep that into mind. But even when you think about that, there is a set of users which are core. There's a set of users which are casual and power, right? Around this frequency, right? Which is to say, for example, for Facebook, there might be users who log in daily, post a lot, view a lot of content, and maybe that's your power user, right, for them. The casual users could be people who come once in a week, and they check a little bit, but they never really post anything, or they never really forward anything or share anything. Right? So there are different ways to define what your audiences are, but the science around this is really around thinking about habit building. And lastly, reactivation. Right? So again, if you think about user states, it's surprising and it's huge how many users become inactive, right, in internet software companies. And the reason for that is you have a very large potential customer base, right? There are 7 billion people in the world. A lot of people can come and visit your website or try to sign up, right? Or even try use your product once. But you lose a lot of them along the way, right? And you want to try and avoid this as much as possible, right? You've paid or you've tried so much to bring all these guys to your product. The last thing you want is these users to go away. So again, there's a lot of science around how do you prevent people from going away or becoming inactive. If they're inactive, how do we bring them back? Right. So this is, again, just to bring it back to all of you guys, this is, we're talking about retention and engagement. Again, you don't want a leaky bucket in your product. And we started with the framework. Right? We started with how do we think about retention and engagement? Once we have all of this thought together, right? Like once we have the framework and a really good fundamental way of thinking about it, then you think about tools, right? There are various tools in the industry. There's onboarding, which is really around activation, right? How much do you want to handhold a customer or user along your journey, right? Along when they're just about starting to use your product. There is notifications, right? Email, SMS, push notification. You can use that very effectively to build habits. Right? One of the best, or a few examples that I've seen which are really, really good, Medium, it comes to mind for me. They send me this daily email of a good sort of summary of top articles, personalized articles for me. That's how I end up landing on Medium almost daily. Right? Another great example of this is a company called Hopper. And they have this product which is really around trying to discover cheapest prices for flights long time in advance, right? Like so 3 months, 6 months. And then on a frequent basis, they'll update you about sort of their latest prices and whether this is the right time to buy, right? But it's a really good way for them to engage with you and make sure that you're thinking about their product the right way and you're thinking about building the habit of really using the product. And lastly, incentives. Right? Incentives are coupons, and a lot of people in the industry use coupons. Very effective in reactivation. You can use it across the board, but definitely very effective for preventing users who are about to go inactive. So again, this was some of the tools around retention and engagement. Loyalty program is a larger area, right? And a lot of companies have been doing it for a long time. And this is, you can date it as far back as like most companies you know, right? And two, like companies like Uber, who just started a loyalty program, right? Like whenever you kind of have a product or service which doesn't necessarily have inherent advantages in virality or inherent advantages of differentiation, right? You need some sort of loyalty program, right? So I switch between Uber and Lyft almost on a daily basis. Some sort of loyalty program will help prevent me from doing that. Right? It's as simple as that. And lastly, sort of community and network effects, right? So this is the reverse side of loyalty programs, right? So if you could build community and if you could build network effects, the simplest way of explaining what this is if by adding more users to your product, the product becomes more and more valuable, you have network effect. Right? And again, a lot of companies in the Valley do that well. Right? Of course, we know the Facebooks and the LinkedIns, but also the Ubers and the Airbnbs and the Lyfts, right? Like where you have a two-sided marketplace, and as there are more drivers and more users come in, it becomes better for everyone. Right? Like the product starts becoming better. If you can inherently build some sort of network effect, you're going to have a very good retention rate. So again, these were four areas around retention and engagement. Lots more. Companies dive really deep into these areas. You have teams of tens of engineers, data scientists, marketers, product managers in every single of this area. Right? So you're talking about large teams and large areas over here. Lastly, let's talk a little bit about data foundation, right? So I'm going to run through data foundation a little quicker, but the simplest way of thinking about all of this is you can't really do acquisition or retention and engagement unless you're really, really data-driven. Right? This is becoming a lot more science, equal parts to art. Right? And you want to have at least the foundations of science to be able to do this. Right? Simple things, right? Like analytics. Right? If you're a really small company, go get an analytics provider and integrate. Right? Google Analytics is free. You have paid versions around the industry, but it's one-on-one. Right? A-B testing, right? Again, you want to try and build your product by knowing the impact of the changes that you're doing. A-B testing is the simplest way to do it. There are pros and cons of overly relying on A-B testing, but it's really, really effective, especially when you're thinking of incremental changes and incremental improvements to your product. Right? Attribution. Right? So again, this is a very growth-specific area. But the idea being, if you have so many channels that we talked around in acquisition, right? And if a person, say, for example, if I spend $100 on Facebook to show an ad and $100 on Google, and if a user has seen both Facebook and Google, I need to know which ad did the user really get influenced by and end up signing for. Was it Google? Was it Facebook? Right? And you can apply this sort of thinking to all of your channels. Right? And attribution helps you do that. It helps you try and decipher or understand the impact of different acquisition channels on your user and on which user has really been brought in by one channel or a combination of all of these channels. And lastly, personalization. Right? So this is sort of the holy grail of the industry. The more personalized you can get, the more you're going to be effective in acquisition, in retention, and engagement. Right? That's quickly to recap for everyone, right? We dove really deep into growth models, right? We talked a lot about acquisition, we talked a lot about retention and engagement, and talked about data foundation, right? In a lot of ways, these are fundamentals or building blocks, right? You can go specifics in each of them and you can read a lot about each of them. But if you think about growth and really think about it from a fundamental perspective, this gives you a lot to start with. Let's now sort of spend the last 5 or 10 minutes talking a little bit about growth teams and skills. What does it take to become a good product manager? All of that fun stuff. Right? So as you guys have probably realized by now, right, growth is fairly cross-functional. Right? You're talking about design, data science, engineering, marketing, at the very least. Right? These are your 4 core functions. And in a lot of ways, the product manager sits and sort of facilitates and helps each of these functions work together. Right? And a lot of ways good growth teams operate and function are around pods. Right? So at Airbnb, we have pods for most of the areas that I went into. Right? And I'll give an example. Right? Say for paid advertising or for virality. We have a pod of marketers, data scientists, engineers and product manager or product managers working together with designers to really further that area, right? And then we use everything else that we need to use in growth, right? Data-driven thought process, experimentation, and building products using frameworks of acquisition, retention, and engagement. I'll give you a few examples of growth PM career paths. At least these are a few examples of at Airbnb, right? I'll give you one of mine, right? So I was an engineer by education. Worked in as a PM for a long time, but at least the last few years was in ad tech, right? So advertising technology used a lot by marketing teams, especially around paid acquisition. And then I transitioned into growth, right? Another path that I know is, and this is again one of my coworkers, an analyst who started off, went into the sort of the marketing team, was a marketer for a long time, and then became a growth PM. Right? And the last example I'll use is a consultant, right? Like a business background, someone who was a consultant for years, and joined sort of as a product specialist, right? Product specialist is a function which is pretty close to product management, and then sort of moved into growth product management again. So in a lot of ways, growth product managers can come from anywhere, right? Especially because the function is faces marketers, data scientists, designers, and engineers. You can really come from any of these areas, right? And you're probably going to be a really good PM over here. What are some of the good skills that are required? So you obviously want to be able to work cross-functionally, right? you need to be able to balance art and science, right? And I've said this before, but it's really about being able to do user research, thinking much more deeply about users, and at the same time, be able to think about experimentation and be data-driven. Right? And lastly, it's really about a mindset, if it were, right? This is fairly different from traditional software product development, right? Where you build a product for a month, and then you are able to think about whether it was successful or not, and that takes, the feedback takes a long time. In growth, your feedback takes days, sometimes hours, right? Depending on the scale of your product. So rapid experimentation and thinking about how you can gather feedback and quickly make adjustments is really important. All of it obviously centered around customer centricity and an impact-driven mindset. So those are some of the skills, I think, not really hard to acquire, but really important to think through what is required from a growth product manager perspective. So I'll wrap it up, guys, and I'll try to give you guys some key takeaways, hopefully, right? So I think we began with talking about growth and why it's important and why it's growing, right, in the industry. And to me, really, it's about a systematic way to thinking about scaling products. And in a lot of ways, my belief is that good product management will ultimately start doing this regardless. We talked a little bit about, or a lot about, key areas in growth, right? We talked about acquisition, we talked about retention engagement, and how it's all driven by a data foundation, right? And lastly, we talked about the growth PM role as well as sort of the teams itself. So that's all the key takeaways. If there's one thing you guys take away from this, right? Think about growth with this simple question. Are enough users using my product, and are they using it as frequently as I expect them to? Right. If you can think about it that way, and everything else just falls from there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.